Good morning, counsel. This is the case of In Re, the State of Brinkman. You may remain seated for just a second. As you can see, six members of the court are here in the courtroom. Justice Miller Lerman is participating by WebEx. She can see and hear your arguments and ask you questions just as if she were in the courtroom.
Good morning. Thank you.
Please, when you are not presenting, keep your masks on. When you are arguing to the court, please take your mask off so that we can hear and understand what you have to say. Do either of you have questions at this point in time?
No, Your Honor.
No, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Then, Mr. Thornton, good morning to you. You may approach and you may proceed.
May it please the court, Mr. Watson. We're here before you again. We were here a while ago, and from the district court's decision finding that Nicole Brinkman was not an heir under the will, that was challenged due to, it was appealed actually, and then the court raised the issue of jurisdiction. Case was reversed and remanded back to the probate court and county court to make a decision. We are now appealing this on behalf of the estate of Michael Brinkman, Seth Brinkman, and Kim Bialis as the next of friend of Seth Brinkman. The county court in its decision was wrong for lots of different reasons. The main reason is that it did not follow the cardinal rule that you honor the testator's intent of what they wanted to leave their estate to. And in this case, it's our position that they clearly left it, Michael Brinkman clearly left it to his son, Seth Brinkman. In his definite, in the will, Mr. Brinkman chose to and did make his own definitions of the terms issue and children. He's allowed to do that both under the Wall case and the Bialis case. And when you read the will in its entirety and construe it liberally as it's supposed to be and take the literal meanings of the words, it's clear that his heir that he wanted to be was Seth Brinkman and any afterborn children. When you look at the Wall case, it clearly states that in that case it was held that the gentleman who made the will first said, I'm going to leave everything to my nieces and nephews. And then later he listed nieces and nephews and did not list five others that he had.
Can you address just the use of the term, the phrase shall include? Why is that not, showing of a non-exhaustive list?
Our position is that include can mean, as I cited in our brief, include can be meaning to limit and restrict, or can also mean, instead of the substitute the word include, means when you use the word include. And in this case, he said includes, and it isn't just Seth Brinkman, but also his afterborn children. So he defined it and included it in a narrow, restrictive way to use the terms issue and children, which again, under the Wall case and also Bialis, that he's allowed to do that. The appellee cited that include should be considered broadening, and I think when we were here briefly the last time, that question was asked. And as the case law indicates, and in the strict reading of that sentence, it can be narrow and just simply mean, this is who I mean to be, my issue and my children.
Does Article 5 shed any light on what Article 1 might mean, particularly the use of pers turpis?
I think that Article 5 is entirely consistent with Article 1. Article 1 defines what Mr. Brinkman wanted issue to mean. Article 5 then used the word issue also. Pers turpis is simply then what lawyers have used for years to mean if my issue, which in this case he defined as Seth Brinkman, were to die and had children, then it goes to his children.
But doesn't that extend the term issue to individuals beyond Seth Brinkman and any afterborn children?
Only in the sense that per stirpes, is, instead of spelling out, well, if Seth were to predecease me, then I want his kids to go ahead and inherit the money. That doesn't change the definition of issue that was used in the will or used in Article 5. That's just simply using a shorthand verbiage that lawyers use to say, well, if Seth dies before I do, then I want it to go to his kids. That doesn't...
If Seth has a child, does that child qualify as issue?
It doesn't come into play unless Seth predeceased him. So in other words...
Right, so let's assume that Seth has a child and Seth has two children and Seth predeceases our decedent. Are those two children of Seth issue under the will?
Because of the words per stirpes being added to it to define what would happen, yes, that falls under it that way. I wouldn't consider that expanding or somehow bastardizing the term issue in Article 1. I don't believe that that's inconsistent at all.
Do you have an ambiguous document here?
No, it's not ambiguous at all. It's very, very straightforward. You just take the words as they are, and it's very straightforward. To try to twist it to somehow make it be something more than what it really is on its face is just a way to try to create an artificial ambiguity.
Seems to me that everybody's struggling with at least two interpretations of the document here. That would make it ambiguous, wouldn't it?
If you think that there's a legitimate, reasonable second alternative, I guess that may be true. But in this case...
Did you acknowledge there's another possible definition of including?
Well, you can take lots of words, and in the dictionary they have lots of different meanings to it. But you've got to take it in the context in which this is put together, the will in its entirety. And the will in its entirety lists who the issue is, who the children are, then goes on in Article 4 to say, I'm going to give my property to my son, Seth. Then in Article 5, it has the to my issue. And that's all consistent. So when you read the will in its entirety, that use of the word includes goes on to say includes these two groups of people.
Hypothetically.
I beg your pardon. Are the words children and issue, as used in Article 1, are they synonymous or are they two different, quote, buckets?
No, I think they're synonymous because of how the sentence is structured and how it was defined. When it says the reference to, in my will to my children, and or my issue shall include my son Seth Brinkman and all children of mine born thereafter. So by that, it's defining the class of both children and issue.
If this were, just hypothetically, if this were an ambiguous document, what is the path that the trial court should have used at that point?
If it was determined to be ambiguous, they should have determined it to be a latent ambiguity. And that's obvious when the county court went outside of the will and said, well, gee, maybe Michael Brinkman worded it the way he did because Seth was born out of wedlock. Well, that's clearly outside of the will. Nicole is nowhere mentioned in here. There's no knowledge of Nicole within the will. So the county court basically violated their own ruling by going outside of the four corners of the will to make conjecture and speculation that wasn't there. So if that's what the case is, then it needs to be considered a latent ambiguity and not a patent ambiguity.
Is Nicole specifically disinherited from the language of the will?
There's not a specific sentence
Does
that
there
says
need to
that.
Be?
I'm sorry?
Does there need to be?
The necessary implication from all the words of the will as a whole, disinheritor clearly, because again, how they defined children and issue, he left everything, all of his property through the residue clause in Article 5, so all of his property was disposed of. So that clearly meets the statutory and the case law requirements to disinherit her without explicitly using her name and saying I disinherit her.
What happens if Seth dies, predeceases Michael, and doesn't leave any heirs?
then Article 7 kicks in, which is his right again to say, I've got this disaster clause, and this disaster clause says, where it was arguable, it becomes intestacy. No, it doesn't. He's defined what would happen. And he has the right, if Seth and all of his kids, or has no kids and predeceases him, to say, all right, well, then I will let Nicole have it. And that's what he did. And that doesn't create...
So she's entitled to receive an inheritance if Seth predeceases and leaves no children.
Correct.
And so how is she specifically excluded or disinherited?
Because if Seth survives him, all of it goes to Seth. That only kicks in the disaster situation. I'd like to reserve at least 45 seconds that I've got left.
You may.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Watson, good morning to you.
Good morning, Chief Justice, fellow justices. May it please the court, Mr. Thornton. My name is Ryan Watson. I represent Nicole Brinkman.
And please take your mask off unless there's some good reason to leave it on. We'll be able to hear you better if you take it off.
I appreciate that. Thank you. This court is really presented with a battle of presumptions. And really that is the presumption against disinheritance versus the presumption of surplusage. The argument by the appellant is generally that these words were put in here for a purpose. And the court is, and he's asking the court to find what that purpose is. Now, it's possible that the court could take that purpose does mean to exclude Nicole. But if we look through the rest of the document, we find, is there any other place where the testator has included words that were not necessary? And we can see that in Article 7. The appellant has referred to this as a disaster clause. But frankly, our case law and our courts already follow that if he were to be rendered intestate, or if there were to be no heirs left in the will, it would flow through intestacy regardless. It's not as if, though, it would escheat to the state. And so with that, we ask, what is the purpose of this disaster clause? Why does it sit there? Is it possible that this testator is essentially trying to bolster his will through statements to include the son, Seth Michael Brinkman, to make possible that there's no confusion as to who is going to take under this will? But if we look at Article 1 and we look at the language that the testator has chosen to use, we can see the difference when he says, the references in this will to my son refer to my son, Seth Michael Brinkman. There's a direct transition of what this refers to. But in the next line, he chooses a different set of words. He does not choose the words refers to. He chooses the words, the references in this will to my children and or my issue shall include my son. Now, if we look at the case of Wall v. Wall, which the appellant relies upon, we see the language in there that goes to the nieces and nephews, says, my nieces and nephews are, and then lists these nephews. That's very similar to the way that the testator has guided the reference of son to his son, Michael Brinkman. It refers to my son. It's a direct replacement of what those words are. However, there's a different set of words when it comes to the word issue. And if we look at the word issue, the appellant is asking you to take a very, very narrow understanding of what issue means. Issue, as it refers to Article 1, means only, as it states, to Seth and all afterborn children. We don't see anywhere that it refers to grandchildren, great-grandchildren, any lineal descendants thereafter. And that's where the definition really departs from the statutory definition of issue, is that following of lineal descendants. It's not the word per stirpes that directs us of further heirs in subsequent generations. It's the word issue. Per stirpes is how it's described as compared to per capita. So if we look at Article 5, we can ask ourselves the statement, I give the residue of my estate to my issue per stirpes. If issue really only means children of mine, born or adopted after the execution hereof, why not simply state per capita? It's going to have the same result. There's no need for a per stirpes definition there. We aren't worried about subsequent generations or how they might take in representation to any other heir under this will. And so we can find that there's really there's not a consistent usage of the word issue. And I think that shines a lot of light on determining whether is this really ambiguous. And I think that kind of becomes clear in the way that it's used in kind of dual purposes throughout the will.
How does the principle of liberal construction of the testator's intent apply to this case?
Well, because the liberal instruction of the testator's intent requires us to take from all parts of the will in order to determine that intent, especially if we're referring to this as a patent ambiguity. And it would be inappropriate for us to place conjecture into that liberal interpretation. And if we, and that's again where I started, where we see the balancing of principles and presumptions in this case, it's long stood that conjecture cannot be used to disinherit the heir. And so if we see in the assignment of errors presented by appellant, they state simply that the county court erred in not expressly finding that she was disinherited. But it becomes clear that there are no words that expressly disinherit Nicole in this will. And so then it kind of follows in the analysis of, is she impliedly excluded? Is it necessary that she be excluded? And we don't see anywhere that it becomes fundamental, logically fundamental, to necessarily disinherit her. You can see in the appellant's reply brief, they cite a good bit of case law regarding how different courts have construed the definition of the word include. Those citations right there should give us some insight as to whether include is really ambiguous or not. We've had a district court that has found one include to mean one result. We found a county court that has found include to mean another result. I think it becomes clear that is ambiguous. More so, if you look at that case law where they talk about different interpretations of the word include, there was one that really kind of struck out to me. And what was important was because of how they cited the case law that court followed. And I believe what that was where you saw the appellant cited the word include is also commonly used in a restrictive limiting sense. And they cited the case of Auer v. Commonwealth out of the Virginia Court of Appeals in 2005. And in the parentheses, they write, relying among other authority on Brian A. Garner, A Dictionary of Modern American Usage, 1998. What's interesting about that, though, is Antonin Scalia and Brian Garner wrote a book called Reading the Law. And if you look at that authority, the interpretation of legal text, the semantic canon, number 15, on page 132, strictly states that the presumption is that the verb include introduces examples, not an exhaustive list.
Does this Scalia and Garner book, it's primarily talking about interpreting statutes and interpreting the Constitution, correct?
Primarily, yeah.
Can we use that in the will construction context?
I think it's a guide, really, for all interpretation of all text. Now, I think there are some differences if we're looking at statutory interpretation versus the interpretation of a testator. But what we have to ask ourselves, while if we're giving liberal interpretation to this, is what did the testator mean? We can employ conjecture to allow an heir to inherit. We cannot employ conjecture to disinherit them. And that's really the stark difference. And so if we look at this, is it quite possible that the testator intended for this will to look to a layperson as if it might go one direction, but to one trained in the law to go to another? There's nothing that would imply to the otherwise on that. Now, and I understand how that may require a little bit of conjecture, but again, there's nothing that forbids that to include an heir and to harmonize all the provisions of the will. And with that, Your Honors, I would ask this court to affirm the trial court's decision. I believe it was accurate and honest.
I beg your pardon, before you sit down, prior to oral argument, you had, filed a motion to dismiss with respect to the appearances of the parties, is that correct?
That is correct.
Could you speak to that? Who's in, who's out, and why they are permitted to appeal? Thank you.
Well, if you look at the record and the filings in the county court, you'll see that Kimberly Millis represents herself as a personal representative, obviously by counsel, but then also carries the torch as the next best friend for Seth Michael Brinkman. Now, it came to our attention during the pendency of this appeal that Seth Michael Brinkman reached majority age. And since that time, we found no filing, no appearance of counsel otherwise, that severs the distinction between Kimberly Millis still representing him as a next best friend versus him representing himself on his own accord.
If the record would show that he came of majority between the time the case was argued but before the decision by the trial court, would that make a difference?
I think it would to an extent, really, as to where we would expect to find the appearance of counsel to be filed for Seth Michael Brinkman.
Are you referring to 30-16012 when you look at who can appeal?
I believe that would be the probate statute for that. Yes, that would. I cannot recall the text specifically off the top of my head, but I believe that would be correct, yes.
Which we've described as generous. It's not the same as the Uniform Probate Code, correct?
Correct, and that would be understood that it would be described as generous. And frankly, it should be, because you would have a minor being involved in the transition of his rights as they were represented. But that nonetheless requires, for in all fairness and due process, and may I continue my statement? I see my time has run out. I think in all fairness and due process, it requires for the other party to know exactly whom they are dealing with. And with that, I would close. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, 43 seconds.
43 seconds, Mr. Thornton.
In light of my 43 seconds, I want to just briefly note in response to the Justice's question about the dismissal, but to point towards our brief that we filed, and it's our position that they're standing by all the parties. Seth entered and filed the appeal in a timely basis. The next of kin has the right, as does the executor, and we've laid out those arguments in our brief. There is no presumption necessary. Michael Brinkman was very clear in what he set out in his will of what he wanted to happen. Taking the word include and fixating on that by itself without reading it in context of the entire sentence is not correct way to approach it. It needs to be read in context and liberally interpreted. Michael Brinkman cannot have his will rewritten or remade by the court. It should be his wishes. The Caudron rule is his interest is the highest and best and should be followed. The county court's decision should be reversed and found that Nicole Brinkman is not an heir under the will. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much. That concludes arguments in In Re Estate of Brinkman. Counsel, please properly distance yourselves on the way out of the courtroom and use your mask if at all possible, and please leave by the side door to my left. And again, thank you very much.